not being enemies of the United States, were specifically excluded from the war powers of this act and from that total authoritarian control of government. And if we go to Section 5B of that act, we find that the president may investigate, regulate, prohibit, or under such rules and regulations as he may prescribe, by means of license or otherwise, any transactions in foreign exchange, export or earmarkings of gold or silver coin or bullion or currency, transfers of credit in any form, other than credits relating solely to transactions to be executed wholly within the United States. So we see that we give the president under Section 5B total authority over all transactions that enemies make. But we see that credits relating solely to transactions to be executed wholly within the United States were excluded from this power. Again, realizing that citizens were not enemies, and the transactions of the citizens within the United States were not enemy transactions. Therefore, the government did not have control over our citizens or their transactions. Now, the concept that of March 6, 1917, that the American people were excluded from the war powers as they were not enemies of the United States is critically important. So let's go back again now to Title 1, Section 1 of 48 Statute 1 of March 9, 1933. And let's see what that act said at Section 2. And here we see that during a time of war or during any other period of national emergency declared by the president may, through any agency that he may designate or otherwise, investigate, regulate, or prohibit under such rules and regulations as he may prescribe by means of license or otherwise, any transactions in foreign exchange, transfers of credit between, or payment by banking institutions as defined by the president, and export, hoarding, melting, or earmarking of gold or silver coin or bullion or currency by any person within the United States or any place subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So now we see that where formerly the citizens and their transactions were excluded from the war powers, that on March the 9th, 1933, as amended, the people of the United States and their transactions were included to be the same as the enemy, that in fact we the people became the same, declared the same as the public enemy. Now let's go to 93-549. In 1973, and we find that our Congress recognized this fact very explicitly. It says that at 48 Statute 1, the exclusion of domestic transactions formally found in the Act was deleted from Section 5B at this time, that we the people were now, and our transactions were now the same as the enemies. Now let's go forward and let's look at Exhibit 21 and see what the Supreme Court had to say. And if we look at Storr versus Wallace in 1921, our Supreme Court says that the Trading with the Enemy Act, originally and as amended, is strictly a war measure and finds its sanctions in the provisions empowering Congress to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on the land and the water. Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11. So here we see that the Trading with the Enemy Act is strictly a war measure. And on March the 9th, 1933, at 48 Statute 1, that war power was applied against we the people and all of our transactions. That was applying an act of war against the American people. Now let's look at the Memorandum of Laws of American cases and recent English cases of law that govern Trading with the Enemy Act. And as we look at this memorandum of law since March 9, 1933, realize that any time you see the word enemy obtained in these memorandums of law, that that applies to you. We look at the first case, the Rapid, and it says that every species of intercourse with the enemy is illegal. This prohibition is not limited to mere commercial intercourse. We go to the Julia. We see that no contract is considered as valid between enemies, at least so far as to give them a remedy in the courts of either government. And they have, in the language of the civil law, no ability to sustain a persona standi in judicio. They have no personal standing in the courts. If we look at the Sally, by the general law of prize, property engaged in an illegal intercourse with the enemy is deemed enemy property. It is of no consequence whether it belongs to an ally or to a citizen. The illegal traffic stamps it with the hostile character and attaches to it all the penal consequences of enemy ownership. We also find in the Rapid that the law of prize is part of the law of nations, and the law that governs trading with the enemy is the international law of prize, the war power. In it, a hostile character attaches to trade independently of the character of the trader who pursues it or directs it. Condemnation to the use of the captor is equally the fate of the property of the belligerent and of the property found engaged in the anti-neutral trade. Let's go to another case. And it says that the produce of the soil of the hostile territory, as well as other property engaged in the commerce of the hostile power, as the source of its wealth and strength, are always regarded as legitimate prize. So here we see that the resources of the people are also regarded as prize. In the William Bagley, we find that in general, during war, contracts with or powers of attorney or agency from the enemy executed after outbreak of the war are illegal and void. Contracts entered into with the enemy prior to the war are either suspended or are absolutely terminated. Partnerships with an enemy are dissolved. Powers of attorney with the enemy, with certain exceptions, lapse. And so here we see that in essence, what they're beginning to say in these cases is that all intercourse is illegal, and that we, the people, come under the absolute domination of the government. We also find in Section 2 of the report of the Senate with the trading with the enemy, at Exhibit 26, that the trade or commerce regulated or prohibited is defined in subsections A, B, C, D, and E of page 4. And this trade covers almost every imaginable transaction and is forbidden and made unlawful, except when allowed under the form of license issued by the Secretary of Commerce. This authorization of trading under license constitutes the principal modification of the rule of international law forbidding trade between the citizens of belligerents. For the power to grant such license, and therefore exemption from the operation of the law, is given by the bill. So here we see that since all intercourse is illegal, once we are declared to be enemies, then the only way that we can conduct any intercourse or trade is under the form of license issued by the government. It should be rather obvious to all that as people today, that we can hardly do anything unless we have a license to do it. This authority derives from the war powers. From Exhibit 727, we read, by this license system, however, we provide a method of relief in individual cases where the relief can be extended without injury to the interest of the country. But it is necessary always to bear in mind that a war cannot be carried on without hurting somebody, even at times our own citizens. The public good, however, must prevail over private gain. And as was said in Bishop versus Jones, there cannot be a war for arms and a peace for commerce. And one of the most important features of the Trading with the Enemy Act is that it provides for the temporary taking over of the enemy property. But we have to realize that the taking is a temporary taking. And the taking of our rights and our property can only extend in so long as the war continues. But once the war terminates, that property and those rights must be returned to the people. So if that be the case, and that the property and the rights were taken by the government, we would probably find evidences of that in further government documentation. If we go to Exhibit 28, Contracts Payable in Gold, 1933, we read, "The ultimate ownership of all property is in the state. Individual so-called ownership is only by virtue of government, i.e. law amounting to mere user, and use must be in accordance with law and subordinate to the necessities of the state." Do we own our property today? Who has the authority to mortgage property? We would have to say, well, only the owner can mortgage property. Ask yourself a simple question. Has your property been mortgaged by the federal government? If it has been, then who owns it? We are only mere users of the property. The rights were seized under the war powers, under the emergency powers, on March 9th, 1933. Let's read on from United States versus Russell, Exhibit 29. "Private property, the Constitution provides, shall not be taken for public use without just compensation." But it goes ahead and says, "Extraordinary and unforeseen occasions arise, however, beyond all doubt, in cases of extreme necessity, in times of war, or immediate and impending public danger, in which private property may be impressed into the public service, and may be seized or appropriated to the public use, or may even be destroyed without the consent of the owner." These principles were well recognized. So now we see what happens when we, the people, fall under the powers of war and under the law of nations of prize, under that Trading with the Enemy Act. And if that be the case, and we see that it was done on March the 9th, then we should begin to look at the documentation leading up to March the 9th to see if we can really identify how this came about and who were the people involved that were doing that. If we go to the papers of Herbert Hoover, on March the 3rd of 1933, we see a response and a resolution that was adopted by the Federal Reserve Board of New York. And this resolution was adopted in response to a letter that Herbert Hoover had sent to the Federal Reserve Board asking for their recommendations on what we might do with the problems we had in our banking institutions. And this resolution says, "Whereas, in the opinion of the Board of Directors of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the continued and increasing withdrawal of currency and gold from the banks of the country has now created a national emergency." Now, let's think about that just a minute. That we, the people, took our money, our gold, and we placed it on deposit with the central banks, the Federal Reserve banks. And they, in turn, gave us a note so that we could go into those banks and retrieve that gold whenever we wanted it. But now we see the Federal Reserve Board adopting a resolution that says, because the people are going into the banks and demanding their money, this is creating a serious national emergency. And we also see at Exhibit 31 that this same Federal Reserve banks proposed an executive order. And this executive order says, "Whereas it is provided in Section 5B of the Act of October the 6th, 1917, as amended, that the President may investigate, regulate, or prohibit under such rules and regulations as he may prescribe by means of license or otherwise, any transactions in foreign exchange, in the export, hoarding, melting, or earmarking of gold or silver coin or bullion or currency." And then it says, ... quotation marks. Now, if we go back to the Act of October the 6th, 1917, and we look at Section 5B, we see that where the asterisk, asterisk, asterisk quotation mark starts, that the original act said other than transactions to be executed wholly within the United States, excluding from this power the transactions of the American citizens. But here we see the Federal Reserve Board proposing a regulation, or executive order, and they come to the point where it excludes the citizens of the United States and their transactions, and they simply quote this act exactly with an asterisk, asterisk, asterisk quotation mark. And anybody that would read the American language and would know how it was used would realize that this is an exact quotation. So we see that the Federal Reserve Board has proposed this executive order to Herbert Hoover. Herbert Hoover declines on March the 3rd to issue this executive order. He's saying it is neither necessary or appropriate to do it. But then let's go to March the 6th, when President Roosevelt, 2 days after he was inaugurated. And on March the 6th, we see a proclamation entitled 2039. And this proclamation says that whereas there has been a heavy and unwarranted withdrawal of gold and currency from our banking institutions for the purpose of hoarding, and here all of a sudden we see because the people wanted the money out of their banks, they were declared to be hoarders. But we also see that in this executive order, in Exhibit 33, that whereas it is provided in Section 5B of the Act of October the 6th, 1917, at 48 Statute 411, as amended, that the President may investigate, regulate, prohibit, under such rules and regulations as he may prescribe, by means of license or otherwise, any transactions in foreign exchange in the export, hoarding, melting, or earmarking of gold and silver coin or bullion or currency, asterisk, 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 quotation mark, exactly as proposed by the Federal Reserve Board on March the 3rd of 1933. We see the exact same language. And yet, if we go back to March the 9th, 1933, and look at 48 Statute 1, Section 2, and what does it then say? Instead of excluding the transactions of the citizens of the United States, it says by any person within the United States or subject to the jurisdiction thereof. This was a misrepresentation of the facts on its face when they misrepresented this act and said that they quoted it exactly when in fact they turned it exactly opposite of what it said. So now when we look at Exhibit 33A, we find that on March the 9th, President Roosevelt reissues this proclamation. The Congress had said that actually the President of the proclamation of March the 6th could not take effect until after they had approved it. They approved it on March the 9th, and as a result of that approval, on March the 9th, President Roosevelt reissued Proclamation 2039 as Proclamation 2040. And it says, whereas under the Act of March the 6th, 1933, all proclamations heretofore or hereafter issued by the President pursuant to the authority conferred by subsection B of the Act of subsection 5B of the Act of October the 6th, 1917, as amended, are approved and confirmed, that he can now issue this proclamation. That's the proclamation that we're operating under to this day. If we now go to the Hoover policy papers, written by the Secretary of Interior and the Secretary of Agriculture, we can read that those speculators and insiders were right was plain enough later on. The first contact of the money changers with the New Deal netted those who had removed their money from the country a profit of up to 60% when the dollar was debased. So now we see some of the problems. The American people were going into the banks and demanding their gold. But here we see in these papers that the insiders had already removed the gold out of the country. So consequently, when the people came for their gold, the banks didn't have it. They now needed protection. They needed military protection. And the people were actually declared to be the enemies. Therefore, the war powers were declared against we the people, and the military protection was offered to protect those banks. Let me see. From the same section 1 of Title 1 of 48 Statute 1 on March 9, 1933, that it goes ahead and says at Section N, whenever in the judgment of the Secretary of the Treasury such action is necessary to protect the currency system of the United States, and the Secretary of the Treasury in his discretion may require any or all individuals, partnerships, associations, and corporations to pay and deliver to the Treasury of the United States any or all gold coin, gold bullion, and gold certificates owned by such individuals, partnerships, associations, and corporations. And we see that whoever shall not comply with the provisions of this act shall be fined not more than $10,000, or if a natural person, may in addition to such fine be imprisoned for a year not exceeding 10 years. So now we see that not only could the people not get their gold, that they were required to turn in any other gold they might have. And that anyone who violated the provisions of this act were now subject to criminal penalties. The takeover of the monetary system was complete. Now let's read from Roosevelt's papers, Exhibit 36. He says that during this banking holiday, it was at first believed that some form of script or emergency currency would be necessary for the conduct of ordinary business. Now realize, on March the 9th, all the money was seized by the Treasury of the United States. So the people were left penniless. They had no money. And Roosevelt recognized very well that we would have to have some form of emergency currency or script to continue the conduct of business. He says, we knew that it would be essential when the banks reopened to have an adequate supply of currency to meet all possible demands of the depositors. Consideration was given by government officials and various local agencies to the advisability of issuing clearinghouse certificates or some similar form of local emergency currencies. On March 7, 1933, the Secretary of the Treasury issued a regulation authorizing clearinghouses to issue demand certificates against sound assets of the banking institutions. But this authority was not to become effective until March the 10th. In many cities, the printing of these certificates was actually begun. But after the passage of the Emergency Banking Act of March 9, 1933, 48 Statute 1, it became evident that they would not be needed, because the act made possible the issue of the necessary amount of emergency currency in the form of Federal Reserve banknotes, which could be based on any sound assets owned by the banks. So now we see in Roosevelt's papers that he's saying the act of March the 9th, 1933, made possible the issuance of emergency war currency in the form of Federal Reserve banknotes that were based upon the assets of the banks. If that be the case, let's go to that same act of March the 9th and let's read Title 4. And let's see if it did in fact give the authority to issue emergency currency. And if we read Title 4, we find that upon the deposit with the Treasurer of the United States, A, of any direct obligation of the United States, or B, of any notes, drafts, bills of exchange, or banker's acceptances acquired under the provisions of this Act, that any Federal Reserve Bank making such deposit in the manner prescribed by the Secretary of the Treasury shall be entitled to receive from the controller of the currency circulating notes in blank, duly registered and countersigned. Now, that's exactly what it says, isn't it? That upon the deposit with the Treasurer of A, the direct obligations of the United States, these are the Treasury notes, the direct obligations, the taxpayer obligations, or the B's, the notes that any one of us might go down to our bank and personally sign, that when either one of the A's or the B's, the private or the public debt, is deposited with the Treasury of the United States, that as soon as the Federal Reserve Bank makes such deposit with the Treasurer, then the controller of the currency is authorized to issue circulating notes in blank, duly registered and countersigned, the emergency currency. Now let's go to the congressional record of March the 9th, and let's see what our congressmen were saying about this. It's Exhibit 38. Mr. McFadden is speaking, and he says, "I regret that the membership of the House has had no opportunity to consider or even read this bill." They didn't have a copy of it. It was an emergency bill. "The first opportunity I had to know what this legislation is was when it was read from the clerk's desk. It is an important banking bill. It is a dictatorship over finance in the United States. It is complete control over the banking system of the United States." He goes on and says, "It is difficult under the circumstances to discuss this bill. The first section of the bill, as I grasp it, is practically the war powers that were given back in 1917. And he goes on talking. And he says, "I would like to ask the chairman of the committee if this is a plan to change the holding of the security back of the Federal Reserve note to the Treasury of the United States rather than the Federal Reserve agent." So you see what he's asking. Prior to 1933, the American people placed their gold on deposit with the Federal Reserve banks. The Federal Reserve banks held that gold as security. And when the American people wanted their money, they took their notes to the bank and got the gold, didn't they? But now we see McFadden asking the question, is this a plan to change the holding of the security from the Federal Reserve banks to the Treasurer? Mr. Stigall answers. He says, "This provision is for the issuance of Federal Reserve banknotes and not for Federal Reserve notes. And the security back of it is the obligations, notes, drafts, bills of exchange outlined in the section to which the gentleman has referred. So the new currency is not secured by the gold. The gold was seized by the government. The new currency is going to be Federal Reserve banknotes that are going to be secured by the obligations of the people held by the Treasury." So McFadden says, then the new circulation is to be Federal Reserve banknotes and not Federal Reserve notes. Is that true? Mr. Stigall says, insofar as the provisions of this section are concerned, yes. We now have the emergency currency. Mr. Britton says, in Exhibit 39, "From my observation of the bill as it was read to the House, it would appear that the amount of banknotes that might be issued by the Federal Reserve System is not limited. That will depend entirely upon the amount of collateral that is presented from time to time for exchange for the banknotes. Is that not correct?" Mr. McFadden says, yes, I think that's correct. Who is the collateral? The A's and the B's are all obligations upon the people of the United States. We became the collateral, the chattel collateral in this country. We became the chattel property. If we look at Exhibit 40, Mr. Patman speaking, he says, "The money will be worth 100 cents on the dollar because it is backed by the credit of the nation. It will represent a mortgage on all the homes and other property of all the people in the nation." Who has the authority to mortgage property? Only the owner. Who is it that has now mortgaged the property? We are not owners, we are only users. The titles were seized on March the 9th of 1933 under those war powers. We also find in 48 Statute 1 that when required to do so by the Secretary of the Treasury, each Federal Reserve agent shall act as agent of the Treasurer of the United States or the Controller of the Currency or both for the performances of any function which the Treasurer or the Controller may be called upon to perform in carrying out the provisions of this paragraph. We see the Federal Reserve at that time was also taken over by the Treasury. We also remember that once the people and the institutions were declared to be enemy institutions, then the only way they could operate is under the form of license. If we go to Exhibit 4 or Exhibit 42, President Roosevelt's papers, we find that the Secretary of the Treasury will issue license to banks which are members of the Federal Reserve System, whether national or state, located at each of the 12 Federal Reserve Bank cities to open Monday morning. So for any bank to reopen on Monday morning, they were now required to receive the license. If we go to Black's Law Dictionary, the current fifth edition that exists today, we can read the bank holiday of 1933, and it sums it all up very well. It says, Presidential Proclamations number 2039, issued March the 6th of 1933, and number 2040, issued March the 9th of 1933, temporarily suspended banking transactions by member banks of the Federal Reserve System. Normal banking functions were resumed on March the 13th, subject to certain restrictions. The first proclamation it was held had no authority in law until the passage on March...